Now we're going to meet a man who bought a house and a plot of land and turned it into what is now a world-famous attraction. His name is Alan Goldsmith, and with his son Jeremy, he owns and runs the House on the Hill Toy Museum and Mount Fitchett Castle at Stansted.
Alan, before we have a look around Mount Fitchett Castle and also have a look at the Toy Museum, how did you first come across this extraordinary piece of land that we're now sitting in?
I purchased it as a house in 1968. It was an ordinary house with 10 acres of the remains of an old castle, the earthworks, and I just wanted it for the land, etc. But when I researched into the castle, the history of the castle, I found it was a very ancient site. It was an Iron Age fort originally, then it was a Roman signalling fort, then it was Saxon, then it was Viking, and then it was taken over by the Normans in 1066. The reason why it was taken over by all those different people, because it was a junction of two big rivers, and also fresh water was there, and it was on top of a large hill. It was a commanding position, in other words, with connections. We have motorways today. In those days, it was rivers where they transported stuff.
So taking on the acreage and also the house, I can understand taking on the house, but what was the original intention? What were you going to do with the land?
Well, it was just wildlife, really, but once I researched into it, I found that William the Conqueror, it was one of a major castles that the Baron here, Baron de Mountfitchet, he had eight castles, most of East Anglia, and this was his head office. And he went from one castle to another, taking all the taxes and so on and so forth. This is his head office. And it was a Motte and Bailey castle made of wood, which they all were in Norman times. And then they slowly built stone, and this was a big stone castle in 1115. And then it was attacked by King John and burnt down to the ground because the knight that lived here, Richard de Montfich II, was one of the 25 barons that forced King John to seal the Magna Carta, and it laid in ruins ever since that period, all stones. And if you notice in Stansted, all the walls are made of flint, and the people came up here, it was like a do-it-yourself centre. Now, they had stones, they come up, if they wanted to build a wall, they pinched the stones from the castle, the remains of the castle. And I decided to rebuild it as it was in 1066. No one's ever done that before in the world, and I thought it would be unique. Of course, I couldn't build it in stone, but I could in wood, as it originally was in 1066. So I went for planning permission, and it was refused five or six times on many different excuses, car parking, access, etc., etc. It's mainly because I was young and I was a rock and roll promoter and I spec'd a bit flash with an E-type and so on. I was that dreadful council kid, you know, an upstart, etc., or whatever. Perhaps that's a chip on my shoulder, I don't know. But anyway, they refused planning permission for 5 years. In the end, it got an obsession to beat these people, these bureaucrats. And so I talked to a lawyer, a barrister, and he said, well, if you get permission for an exhibition on the site, everything becomes an exhibit, even if it's a full-scale house. So I went back to them and said, look, I don't want to build the castle anymore, but I'd like to open the grounds and mow the grass and let the public walk over the grounds, but I'd like an exhibition of life in the 11th century on an 8x4 piece of board. And their vision was 8x4, so they could see that. And they then gave me permission to open the grounds and an exhibition of life in the 11th century. But the word exhibition, everything became an exhibit. And so I merrily went ahead and built it. And then they tried to stop me, and in the end they gave me retrospective planning. And now it's one of the major tourist attractions in England. We've had over 2 million visitors, won the school visits, and even English Heritage praise us, and it's where they bring people here to show how it should be done as commercially, and here we are now.
That explains Mount Fitchett Castle, but it doesn't explain your other obsession, or one of your other obsessions, which is collectibles and particularly toys, because that house that you bought back in 1968 is now just internationally known as the House on the Hill Toy Museum. So we know about the castle now. So how did the house suddenly become a toy museum?
Well, that's an interesting. I said to my wife, because we had this 10 acres of the castle, I said, I'm going to build a castle. And she thought, oh, yeah, for another one of his mad schemes, forget it. And suddenly, you know, when the palisades went up and the crowds started to arrive, thousands of people in what was, you know, the site. So I then had to turn the house into a commercial proposition. And I collected toys because I was born at the beginning of the war and didn't have any toys. Anyone brought up in the 40s didn't have toys because there was none about. You had hand-me-downs. And so I started collecting toys, trying to recapture my childhood, I expect. And so I turned the house into a toy museum, and I went for planning permission for that, and they turned me down for that. I mean, when you think of a museum, open at 10, closing at 5, no music, just a museum, heritage and all the rest of it. So I went to the government appeal on that. Didn't trick them. They're up to my ways, so I couldn't trick them again. And the government overruled the local council, and I did get permission. And I think it's rather sad that, you know, you have to fight for these things. And a lot of people would have been put off, but I got the BMW bonnet to beat these bureaucrats. And it is now the largest privately owned toy museum, not only in Essex or in England, it's the largest one in the world. We have over 70,000 toys on display. And my son, he runs it now, and we have also military of World War One, World War Two, a rock and roll exhibition. And once again, you know, it's very successful and people love it. It's a daylight dream to come here.
The whole thing that you're describing, there's one word that sums it up in a way, and it's nostalgia. I know for a fact, having visited the Toy Museum over the years, that although, obviously, on paper, it looks like a great day out for the kids, and particularly Mount Fitchett Castle, because it's not just a thrill, it's educational, it reminds people of where we've come from and what we're about. The Toy Museum does exactly the same thing, but in a strange sort of way, it does it for the adults as well as the children. In fact, if anything, more for the adults.
Yeah, it's a daylight dream. You see, the vast majority of people, 99% of people, have had a lovely childhood, and they come to a toy museum and they see the toy that Auntie Flo gave them when they were 4 or 5, and they've forgotten about Auntie Flo because she's been dead about 30 years, and it reminds them of that lovely Christmas with Auntie Flo or their late mother or father or whatever. And so they have a daylight dream, and that brings back that nice warm glow, remembering those, as you say, nostalgia. And the most phrase that everyone says, oh, I remember I had one of those. So it's a daylight dream, and it is nostalgia for old England, really, the castle. And the animals at the castle, as you know, we rescue animals here. They all live to a lovely old age. And they have this unique experience where children can actually stroke deer and they become friendly, where they can't get it anywhere else in this sort of politically correct atmosphere or country we're in at the moment.
And as far as the toy museum is concerned, the collectibles must become even more unique now, bearing in mind the sort of the age of the electronic toy. We're not even into that anymore. It's gone way beyond all of that. Yeah. When I first used to come and talk to you about it, we were marvelling at robots and things like that. Yeah. Now, I mean, they're almost becoming a thing of the past because there's a new generation of extraordinary toys coming in. We hear about children spending all their time on their iPads and their iPhones and all that sort of thing. So those things in the toy museum become even more special.
Well, they do, really, but everyone moves along the trough, and those, what you're talking about, those games, handheld electronic games, they're becoming very collectible now because the people that used to play with them was 20 years ago, so they're adults now, and it's like, you know, Tiny Tears dolls and Cindy dolls, you know. No one wants Bisque-headed dolls now, Victorian, because they can't relate to them, but the young ladies or mothers over 45, 50, they can remember their Cindy doll and the fashion, the clothes they were, so they're getting valuable. And toys have actually become an international commodity. They become an art form. So some toys can go, like I saw the other day, a tin aeroplane went $200,000. So they're collected all over the world because every little boy and every little girl in the world, doesn't matter what country they had a dolly or an aeroplane or a car or whatever, and robots. And so they've become, as well as nice and visual to the eye, they've become an investment where people are buying them for investment and making money. But of course, like everything, investments, some year everyone wants a certain thing, another year that's gone off. It's like Beanie Babies, no one wants them, no one wants Avon cosmetics, the perfume bottles. Human beings, or adults I should say, are like children. They go on crazes. It's the craze thing, you know, and we are just like children. But, I mean, collecting is a disease. A doctor came here once and said, you know, that I should see a doctor. He's most probably right, of course. We've known that for years. Psychiatrist, I think. But it's changed. As it was toys years ago, no one, when you were a young girl and I was a young boy, we didn't collect toys for money. They weren't an investment. Now they are. You have big auctions of toy auctions, doll auctions, you know, so they become like an oil painting, really. They're the same commodity. And they are now going, as I say, for mega money. Not all, of course. Some are worthless. But, you know, you've got the whole spectrum of price and investment.
Well, before Nicola and I give ourselves a treat by going round, one question, which is probably impossible to answer. I know that your obsession began with a little toy train when you were 7 years old, but God forbid, if the toy museum caught fire, what is the one thing in there that you would rush to save?
That's very interesting. I don't know. I think I'd be like a rat up a drainpipe. I wouldn't know where to go first because there's so many, and I'd be running from here, there and everywhere, and in the end I'd get burnt to bits. So it's a question that I've been asked a lot, and honestly, I don't know. I wouldn't know where to go first, to be quite honest. I like tin robots. I like the trains. It's so vast and so big on two floors, I would really be spinning around on the spot with my hair on fire, I think.
That'll do.